Our next case for argument is United States against Poletti. Mr. Rolaga.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You can raise the podium. There's a switch on the right-hand side.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, I'd like to address first the factual basis issue on the brief, and then I'll move in to the ineffective assistance of counsel. With respect to the factual basis, the district court found that Mr. Poletti intentionally implied that he would help continue to procure a contract for Mr. Ibrahim by he intended to mislead Mr. Ibrahim to believe he would continue to get a contract by the fact that he accepted the $50,000 in his office and with a contemporaneous statement, see what you can continue, see what you can do. And when analyzed in a vacuum, that may be reasonable to infer an implied continuance, but in the context of the record, it becomes unreasonable. And considering the record, you had Mr. Poletti, who prior to this meeting told Mr. Ibrahim, I can't get you a contract. He told him detailed reasons why he couldn't get him the contract. He told him he's leaving the Middle East theater and would have no authority to influence any contracts. At the meeting, he's approached Mr. Ibrahim and he tells him, I can't get him the contract. Mr. Ibrahim hands him a bag. Mr. Poletti takes it. Inside is $50,000. And Mr. Poletti responds, I can't do anything for you. Mr. Ibrahim then says, see what you can do. And Mr. Poletti again says, there's no way.
But, Mr., I have a couple of questions. First of all, before all of this begins, at the original plea proceeding, the district court does describe to Mr. Poletti what the statute covers. You knowingly and directly and corruptly receive and accept a thing of value, the $50,000. It's in an effort to steer a U.S. Army contract for food service supplies and so on. Is it your argument that the judge fails to describe the offense properly to Mr. Poletti? Because I'm trying to keep my eye on the fact that this is, in the end, an effort to withdraw a plea of guilty. And your argument is that Mr. Poletti did not make that plea of guilty knowingly and voluntarily and all the rest of that, particularly knowingly. And so do you think that there's anything wrong with the way the judge described the offense to him before he gets into the more particular questions?
I think there's a problem with the way he fails to articulate the corrupt element. And especially in light of the situation where everybody was agreeing that Mr. Poletti did not, in fact, intend to carry out procuring a contract.
But I thought it was pretty clear, and that even you agreed, that if Mr. Poletti, knowing that he couldn't actually deliver the contract, intended to create the impression in Mr. Ibrahim that the money was going for that end, that would be enough. I mean, falsely creating the impression.
I think that Mr. Poletti needs to intend to create that impression.
Right, yeah. So correct. If Mr. Poletti goes to Mr. Ibrahim's place of business, has the conversation, you know, walks away with the money, and Mr. Poletti throughout this is trying, you know, through a wink and a nod to say, yeah, I'll take the money, then he intends Mr. Ibrahim to believe that he will do something helpful for Mr. Ibrahim, that would be an offense.
Yes.
Your problem is that that's not spelled out in this
That's correct.
Exchange.
And I think in considering that this testimony was during a plea colloquy in which Mr. Poletti was trying to set forth facts to help support the charge as opposed to in a trial trying to negate an element, and it was very difficult to find out, well, what happened? What did you tell him? And really what Mr. Poletti told him is, I couldn't do anything. And the fact that Mr. Ibrahim may or may not have believed Mr. Poletti would try, maybe he was hedging his bets. There's a lot of reasons why people in this situation where there's contracts worth a lot of money would take the chance and let this person keep the money who clearly needed it and who told him, I can't do anything.
Right. Well, that leads to two questions on my part. The first is that in the writing of your brief, I get the impression that you think that the thing Mr. Pelletti had to be promising to do was give the contract to Mr. Ibrahim. But it seems to me sometimes a government official is in a position to recommend something, not actually to do it, but to recommend. And surely the statute prohibits a bribe designed to elicit a favorable recommendation. I mean, the probation office writes pre-sentence reports all the time, and they recommend a particular sentence. And definitely, it seems to me, if somebody were to bribe the probation officer to write a PSR that recommended a very low sentence, that would violate 201. So I want to think about the difference between actually giving the contract and recommending is the first thing. And secondly, I know this may get over into your ineffective assistance of counsel argument, but I'm interested in what you think the difference is between the gratuity statute and the bribery statute, and why you think maybe what happened here was a gratuity.
Yeah, I think with respect to the bribery statute, and if Mr. Pelletti communicated and intend to communicate that I will help influence a contract,
including a recommendation,
including a recommendation, I think that assuming it was still in its official capacity to do so, would be covered under the bribery statute. I don't think that's what happened, and I don't think that's what was communicated at all to Mr. Ibrahim. I do think that Mr. Pelletti certainly may have, by acceptance of the money, committed a bribery, and that Mr. Ibrahim's either giving money for benefits in the future when there's not necessarily a quid pro quo is covered under the gratuity statute. In other words, hey, maybe, Mr. Pelletti, you'll help me out in the future on something. And I think that is covered under the gratuity statute, and that's certainly something that Mr. Pelletti may be culpable for. But I think there is a large distinction between the mental state, between a bribery and the gratuity, which is why the corresponding penalties are drastically different. Segueing into the ineffective assistance of counsel, I think that the district court, as well as the government, relied in part on United States Renari, which suggests that additional factual investigations, a defense attorney may forego those if a client claims he's guilty and sets forth sufficient facts for the attorney to not see the need to engage in additional factual investigation.
And is the problem here factual? It's hard for me to see how much more the lawyer could have found out on the facts unless he actually thought he could find Mr. Ibrahim, which seems somewhat unlikely to me, but maybe he could have. But I thought the argument was really more that the lawyer didn't push the legal possibilities.
Yeah, yes, and I think that they're segued into one. I said, one, the reading the statement does not, in fact, admit a bribery. There is no connection between the $50,000 and doing anything, which should have created Mr. Robinson to inquire more. And what Mr. Pelletti told him is, I told him there's no way. I told him I had no more authority. I told him I was leaving. And at that point, he failed to communicate to Mr. Pelletti any potential meritorious defenses, including that what witnesses did the government have to prove any of this? Certainly, Mr. Ibrahim, being a Saudi national, is not a likely witness.
Well, they have his admission to the... I mean, if taking the $50,000 under the circumstances actually amounts to a 201B2A offense, then they have his admission.
Certainly, and I don't think it does. If you read the statute, if you read it, it simply says, I met Ibrahim, we wanted to get a contract, he gave me $50,000, I spent it on various things, and I felt bad, and I didn't influence any illegal contracts. And so there's a hole in, well, what was that money given for? Was it a gratuity? Was it a gift? Or was it a bribery?
Well, but that's after the district judge initially refused to take the plea. In the supplemental colloquy, one of the questions the judge asked was, and I quote, whether it was your belief that he was giving you this money for the purpose of influencing official actions.
Yes. And
your client answered, yes. I don't understand why that isn't enough. under the statute?
Because he knew why the money was given. It was clear. He never disputed why. What the distinction is he told him no, and he never had the requisite intent to mislead.
How could Ibrahim have had the belief that he was influencing official actions if he had been told in no uncertain terms, absolutely not, no?
Well, Mr. Ibrahim may or may not have believed that. It is somewhat speculative, but Mr. Ibrahim could have been hedging his bets, and it appears my time is up, Your Honor.
Well, I want to ask you about the ineffective assistance, at least. As far as ineffective assistance, is it your position that had the lawyer's name?
Mr. Robinson.
Robinson looked into this on his own, and he would have realized that without the testimony of the defendant and just given this statement, that there couldn't have been a conviction of bribery?
That's correct.
And that he should have advised him and said, look, there's no admission here of bribery. We'll get back to the gratuity issue, I guess. But then he would have just insisted on a trial, I guess.
I think that is correct. And the fact that there was no other evidence and he did not make a knowingly and intelligent waiver because he didn't have those options before him.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alotta. Mr. Hartzler.
Your Honor, from the government's perspective, the difference between bribery and gratuity is that bribery is futuristic and gratuity is for past action.
But that's not what the statute says. I thought that for a minute, but then I was looking at subpart C and toward the end of this long list of things in 1B, you know, demands, seeks, receives, accepts, etc., anything, because of any official act performed or to be performed by such official or person. So I got stuck on what's the difference between the performance of any official act that you're going to do tomorrow and an act that is to be performed. And perhaps the difference is that adverb corruptly. On the other hand, I don't know, they're awfully close.
They're very close.
And how the lawyer could not have said to Mr. Pelletti, you know, your confession shows that you got the $50,000, so once a diversionary disposition's off the table, something is going to happen, but maybe you could plead it down to gratuity, 2 years maximum in prison. That's something of a benefit to people. Don't you think if he had pleaded to 201C?
I don't know that that was an option, though. I don't also know whether it was explored, but I don't think
why not? I mean, why shouldn't it at least have been explored by a competent lawyer?
I'm not suggesting that it shouldn't have been explored. I just don't know that it was not. There is no testimony in that, I realize. And I also think that the government was asking for the bribery. The government was prepared to charge bribery, wanted to charge bribery. I don't know that there was any opportunity. I think that the lawyer and Mr. Pelletti took the position that their best option was to cooperate. As you know, he went into the grand jury. His statement refers to bribery and being contacted by other contractors. And I think ultimately the conclusion was that the sentencing was not going to make a difference between the two. I completely appreciate that the range would come out differently for the gratuity versus the bribery. But I think the conclusion was that if he cooperates, you recall, there was some hope that he might even get off with probation. You also remember...
I thought the government squelched that hope relatively early on. Was that not right?
Well, the government, of course, doesn't decide what the ultimate sentence is, so I don't think the government may have suggested it was not going to recommend probation, if that's what you're asking. I thought that Mr. Pelletti and his lawyer had some hope that they might still get probation after extensive cooperation. I didn't mean to imply that the government was going to agree to it. I don't think the government would agree to it any more than I think the government would have agreed to a gratuity statute in this case. I don't know. I can't tell you, and there's certainly nothing in the record about that. But I think the government saw this as a bribery case from the get-go. I think Mr. Robertson, based on the admission and the statements in the written report with the agents, concluded that it was a bribery case. And their best option was to cooperate with the government, testify before the grand jury, and hope for the best sentence possible.
Here's the question that was never asked quite in so many words of Mr. Pelletti at the colloquy, although, as Judge Easterbrook says, perhaps one can infer the answer. But no one ever says to Mr. Pelletti, at the moment that Mr. Ibrahim gives you this money in the hope that you will continue your efforts to, you know, fill in the blank, recommend, get, whatever, the contract, were you intending to convey to Mr. Ibrahim the impression that you would do that? In other words, getting it from Mr. Ibrahim's state of mind back into Mr. Pelletti's intent.
Well, there's
no one ever quite says that to him. All he ever says about his intent is, I keep telling him I couldn't do it, that it was a KBR contract, that it was a done deal.
Well, he says that it was a done deal, but he also hears Mr. Ibrahim say, continue, see what you can do to continue. That's really what this case comes down to.
The case comes down to, and I guess Mr. Pelletti never quite admits, and I conveyed the impression to him that I would do that and that I had some hope of success.
Well, he never admits that he conveyed the impression.
Right.
The judge concluded that he did, made the factual finding that the facts were sufficient to infer that that's the impression he left. Yes. Obviously, we're far more refined on the issue today than we were at the plea colloquy. He got new counsel. They focused on this issue. We focused on our briefs. As you and I seem to agree, it comes down to the six words that were spoken by Mr. Ibrahim at the time the money was passed. Not entirely the six words. I mean, obviously, he was called to go there alone, and he traveled alone. He left his driver outside. So he knew something suspicious or nefarious was likely to occur. Whether it was going to be a gratuity, bribery, who knows. But the words were not, thank you very much for all you have done for me in the past. I'd like to make your time worthwhile for what you've done. I know you're now leaving back and going back to the United States. No, it's, well, see what you can continue. See what you can...
Could you just tell me, are there other statutes? I'm surprised in some ways that the government was limiting itself to this, because I can assure you that if some Saudi guy approached any of the three of us on the bench and said, we really appreciate the fine work you're doing for the United States, here's $50,000, there are all manner of laws that would prohibit us from accepting that money. We'd be down to the U.S. Attorney's office saying somebody's, you know, doing something highly wrong. So surely for military officers, there must be statutes that regulate gifts from foreign governments or gifts, period. Is that not so?
I do not know. I wouldn't be surprised. You've got to appreciate that this came up with a seemingly full confession to the agents.
Right.
He waived indictment, had a lawyer, agreed to plead guilty to the bribery offense. Were there other statutes that might have been explored? I mean, it's certainly possible.
What do you know what his exposure was under military law?
I have no idea. I have no idea what his exposure under military law would have been. No, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some military law that applies.
Well, certainly there's military law that applied. This occurred while he was on active duty. And for all I know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice still provides for hanging for this offense. It certainly used to.
Yes, well, that wasn't an option that was exercised.
Actually, during the Civil War, quite a lot of military officials were hanged for this offense.
One thing he said, though, at some point, is that he was, and I think in his written statement, that he was offered, I guess, bribes or whatever, but from other people.
Correct.
Isn't that correct?
Oh, yes.
And that this was something that was sort of common, which is not particularly admirable, but that it, But he didn't take them, or at least he didn't say at that point that he took them.
Well, he took some of them. He took some of them.
Yeah, I think he looked at those as probably gratuities or gifts or just favors or something or other.
I think he essentially said he didn't take any of it corruptly. He didn't take any of it to influence the contract, but took a number of gifts, I believe, is the way it came out.
Well, it seems that it's the amount of the money that kind of raises this one above, say, well, nobody give away $50,000 and try to say, well, it's a billionaire. You know, it's like the money we're talking about now about bailouts. A billion doesn't mean much anymore. Maybe $50,000 to the billionaire, if that's a fact, wasn't that much. But I guess the question it comes back on the, I guess what was presented to this lawyer, which maybe it's not yours to argue, but that he was ready to quit. He was ready to throw in the towel. He was going to admit he wanted to cooperate and all that sort of thing. And maybe the lawyer takes that as a package as opposed to digging into everything and saying there's more that you could do, maybe. But as far as the government's concerned, they came with this statement and with the hat in hand, ready to take what they could get, I guess.
Ready to put the matter behind him, anxious to resolve it, waived indictment, was ready to cooperate. In fact, very shortly after first met his lawyer, testified before the grand jury, this was a defendant, not atypically, who was ready to cooperate, understands the opportunity and the value to the government of testifying before the grand jury, did so. We can all speculate as to what would have happened had he continued to cooperate. And now, based on what Judge Easterbrook's telling us, should he get a reversal in this case, he may face hanging as a result of the military.
I just said I didn't know what the UCMJ provides.
Somehow I doubt that, but he certainly might face something.
Yes.
And no pension, which appears to have been. I mean, I don't think he would. It seems to me even the gratuity statute would have had that consequence.
I just wanted to point out one feature of the three-decade-old Arroyo case in which the Seventh Circuit pattern jury instructions are written. Judge Wood, it wasn't the $50,000 and was offered, it wasn't $50,000, it was much less, but not instead of saying, well, we'll take this downstairs to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, this court suggested the answer might be, no, of course not. You're dealing with the United States government, and we don't do things that way.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Hartzler. The case will be taken under advisement.